This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. President Barack Obama recently visited Britain and Germany, and he had two very different messages for these two nations. To Britain, he said, "You'd better stay in the European Union if you expect to maintain a strong relationship with the U.S. And to Germany, he said, "This relationship is unshakable." It was quite a stark contrast between these two messages. And it's also very significant. In our first segment, we're going to talk about why. In related news, some politicians in Germany are questioning their nation's relationship with the Jewish state of Israel. They're talking about how they need to drop what has been Germany's unconditional support for the Jewish state. The German government was quick to say that the official position toward Israel has not changed, but we're going to talk about why these are comments that should not be ignored. As a presidential race in America heats up, so too do the tensions in the United States. They seem to be building around one candidate in particular, Donald Trump. Groups of protesters are growing around his campaign rallies. In some cases, they're even turning violent. Where is this leading, and how bad will it get? What can we expect to see in the months leading up to elections in November? And I'll conclude today's show by talking about why the fact that everything you own breaks down actually gives you a wonderful opportunity. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. President Obama confirms the special relationship is dead. That was our cover story on last week's Trumpet Weekly by Trumpet executive editor Stephen Fleury. Last week, President Obama visited Britain, and he basically told them, if you leave the European Union, don't expect any special treatment from the U.S. We don't have time to treat you specially separate from the EU. Well, after he left Britain, President Obama visited Germany, and he had quite a different message. This is another aspect of this story that we need to talk about. And to do so, I have Trumpet writer Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in Britain. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So first of all, tell us about what President Obama did and said while he was in Germany.
Well, he went to Hanover and he gave this really quite strong pro-European speech. I mean, you've got to remember this is a time of year where a time where a lot of Europeans are becoming disillusioned with Europe, cynical about Europe. It's becoming less and less popular to support Europe. But he gave a very passionate and ideological defense of Europe. So he talked about how the United States and the entire world needs a strong and prosperous and democratic united Europe. He called it one of the European Union, one of the greatest political and economic achievements of modern times. He talked about how vital they were, Europe is to international order. And he quite strongly encouraged Europe to spend more on their military as well and more on their defense. So very pro-European speech. And then also it's interesting that when he gives this pro-European speech, he goes to Germany to do so.
Clearly the strongest nation within Europe. He recognizes that, and kind of a tip of the hat to Chancellor Merkel.
Exactly. And it shows the strength of friendship and trust America has in Germany as well.
This is obviously a relationship that we're watching closely, and Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily program recently, that the relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. being fractured, and then the relationship between the U.S. and Germany being strengthened, that's something that we've had our eye on for quite a while.
Right, and they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And it's interesting the way we saw them both in this visit. And on the visit to Britain, we quite clearly saw that relationship fracturing. And then the day later, he goes straight to Germany, the main nation that we've pointed to as being one of these new allies that America is seeking out and trusting in. And then giving this speech, encouraging the whole of the EU, and then putting a lot of America's trust in terms of defense within the United Nations and encouraging them to invest in new capabilities and to expand their ability there.
So just give us an idea of what's motivating the president as he's encouraging Europe to beef up its military, to take more responsibility for its own defense. Maybe you can just put that in its broader context for us.
Well, I think some of that is unique to Mr. Obama and Mr. Obama's foreign policy. We've talked a fair bit on this program about how he is stepping back from the world. He wants America to do less. And one of the key countries to kind of, or areas that he could, that he would want to take up the slack is Europe and is the European Union. And we've written for a few years now. I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, he talked about his pivot to Asia. And in order to pivot to Asia, he wanted Europe to do more. So there's that aspect of it that is quite unique to Mr. Obama. However, there's also a much, there's a long tradition of America placing a lot of trust within the European Union and encouraging the European Union. To see this, you have to go all the way back to the late 1940s. The end of World War II was over. The Iron Curtain, it wasn't yet clearly drawn across the Europe, but you could still see those two power blocks rising, the Soviet Union, America. The Soviets had spies going around funding, supporting communist movements all across Europe to try and turn nations to their side. And at the same time, America was using the CIA, and before the CIA was formed, the OSS, the I think it was the Office for Strategic Services, to try and fund pro-democratic movements and to create American allies. But a major part of the OSS and the CIA's work was in promoting the European Union. And they saw, and they put a lot of effort into building up a united Europe as something to help them defend against the Soviet Union. And they saw this as a vital part of American strategy to prevent Soviet enlargement. And so this OSS, they founded an organization called the American Committee on United Europe, or the ACUE, and that was the main vehicle of the CIA to fund money into Europe. And so by the mid-1950s, they were funding pro-European and pro-kind of European Union groups within Europe to the tune of around $1 million a year. And that was one of their most expensive covert operations in that period. So it was a very important part of the work for them. And so it arranged discreet American financial assistance to things like the Council of Europe, the Schuman Plan, the European Army, and a lot of these people that we call the founding fathers of Europe today, Schuman, Monet, they received a lot of American support and they received a lot of American money. It's not that they did what they did in founding the EU only because America wanted them to, or that they were kind of paid shills of the United States. I think they genuinely and ideologically believed in what they were doing, but they got a lot of help in that from America. So America has invested a lot in building the European Union right from the start.
I'm just thinking, as you're speaking, of the statements that Herbert W. Armstrong was making at the time. This is right after World War II, and he talked about just how we just don't seem to be able to focus on more than one enemy at a time. During World War II, it was the Nazi regime. Of course, we were fighting in the Pacific theater as well. But as soon as our attention began to shift to the Soviet threat, then we stopped looking at Europe and Germany in particular as an enemy, and we started looking at them as allies. And he really warned right from the very beginning, as soon as this policy became apparent, this was going to end badly. Now here we are, you know, quite a ways down the track, and you've seen this. I mean, those early investments that America made in trying to build Germany up and to unify Europe, and certainly you could look at the Marshall Plan and the rebuilding of Germany in that context. What we did to help the industrialization of Germany and its economic building, but today there's this more of this political support for what's happening, basically saying you've got to take care of yourselves because we just can't do this anymore. There is a certain pragmatic consideration here, but it is interesting to see President Obama such a strong supporter of this idea of internationalization, of the power of international structures to create a peaceful environment and that kind of thing, a lot of faith that he's placing in Europe to do this, and no hint of any kind of a concern that this might backfire.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned the Marshall Plan. That European integration was one of the stated goals of the Marshall Plan. And when countries like France at one point was not playing ball, America actually threatened to cut off the aid they were getting under the Marshall Plan. So they used that to help build up the European Union. But no, I agree with everything you said. And I think one interesting thing is, right at the start, after World War II, of course, you had a lot of people thinking about, okay, how do we solve the German problem? Germany's just started two world wars. How do we contain them? And Churchill did put forward the idea of a united Europe as one way of containing Germany. And he made very clear that he didn't think Britain should be in that union. He also made very clear that he thought it should be made sure that Germany didn't dominate it. And Germany at that time was split into two. So there was initially some people also seeing a united Europe as a way to contain Germany. But those kind of fears seemed to fall by the wayside pretty quickly. And it just became about building Europe up as an alternative to the Soviet Union.
You know, it really is quite extraordinary example of what happens when you lack that prophetic understanding and that prophetic overview. You're having this kind of a policy toward Germany, and you look at the way that the United States has even treated Britain, from the very beginning, even Britain's attitude toward what was happening in Europe, that Mr. Armstrong, looking at the prophecy of the Bible, he said that Britain should never get mixed up in this project. He warned from the very beginning, back in the 1970s, when they entered the European Economic Community, that this was going to end badly. Here we are today. Britain has finally, after the disaster that followed over the last 30-plus years, and they've come to the same conclusion that Mr. Armstrong had way back, based on those prophecies. Even the United States has encouraged, President Obama was very outspoken in saying, you had better stay a part of this. If you get out, you're going to have problems with us.
Right. And again, America's been supporting Britain being within the European Union right from the start. The CIA groups spend a lot of time, a lot of effort turning the Labour Party's opinion around on the European Union, because the Labour Party was initially against Europe, because of course they had some sympathies with the Soviet Union and with communism. They didn't want to be a part of the Soviet Union. America put a lot of effort into turning that around, and then the CIA also funneled money to pro-European groups when Britain held the referendum, its first referendum on remaining in the European Union, back in 1975, and so they had a lot to do with convincing Britain to stay in then. So yeah, they certainly didn't see it as a mistake all the way back then, and of course they still don't today.
How much do you what do you see as unique to President Obama? You've mentioned that both a little bit of a fracturing of the relationship with Britain, or their encouraging the unification with Europe, and the effort to encourage European unification and even to strengthen Germany, that this is a trend that goes back quite a ways. But how much has President Obama intensified that? What do we see that's unique to him?
Well, one thing, for example, we see this transatlantic trade treaty that he's working quite hard to push. A lot of that's been negotiated under his presidency, and that's not something that has been done before, because it's hard to make too many comments on this because a lot of those texts and things are secret. We don't know exactly what's in it, but it would probably mean giving the European Union a lot of say on various different bureaucratic rules that may well even apply within America to American products. So even just in that one example where some cooperation is greatly intensified under Mr. Obama, I think you see a lot of the way that he thinks like a lot of the people in Europe. We see this again in the same way that he likes to appoint unelected bureaucrats to various different positions. There's definitely a meeting of minds there. But then also, like we mentioned at the start, just he's got a much greater willingness than just about any other president to see Europe take on a greater role so America doesn't have to. I think other presidents would have still liked to see Europe do more. For example, I think Mr. Bush wouldn't have been disappointed if France and Germany decided to get involved in Iraq. But this, but that was alongside the United States. I think what's really unique to Mr. Obama is the instead of the United States approach that he is really pushing Europe to adopt.
There's a prophecy that we talk about specifically about just the German-American relationship being a type of a lover relationship that's going to end with a betrayal. And I guess it's the Ezekiel, the end time prophet booklet that we have that discusses that specifically in Ezekiel 23. Certainly something that anyone who's interested in getting that prophetic perspective on these events would do well to check into. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. And look for the under the literature tab, the Ezekiel Watchman booklet. There's a chapter about that specifically, about a German double cross. But definitely, you can see how these events today are leading to that and setting us up for that kind of a fall as that relationship fractures. And just this is the problem with trusting former enemies. And a failure of imagination to see how that could really end badly.
Right, and Mr. Flory also, he wrote an article on after the spying scandal, the NSA, and he talked about how America is pursuing Germany, but then used some of the fallout of the scandal to show that America doesn't view Germany the same way. I mean, Germany doesn't view America the same way. Germany doesn't trust America and actually resents a lot of what America does, even while America pursues this lover's relationship. And I was reminded of that on a few different occasions after this visit that Mr. Obama made to Germany, because there are a few different articles making exactly that same point, just citing different opinion polls and the views of the Germans and how Mr. Obama was very strongly pursuing Germany, but there's a very strong negative perception of America within Germany, and a lot of Germans do not want a closer relationship and fundamentally do not trust America at all.
Well, thanks for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer, and he's working on an article about this America-European relationship, America's support for the EU and Germany in particular. You can look for this in the coming days on thetrumpet.com. Richard, we appreciate your time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We're going to look now at a related story, that is Germany's relationship with the Jewish state of Israel. The same biblical prophecies that we were just talking about regarding Germany's relationship with the U.S. also apply to its relationship with Israel. A lot of people looking on the surface see this relationship as being very strong. Some Jewish leaders see a true friend in this nation that perpetrated the Holocaust against the Jews in World War II. But there are signs that point to a different reality, and those include some indications out of Germany recently that we're going to talk about here. I have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques here to discuss this. Hello.
Hi, great to be here.
So tell us about this story out of Germany regarding its approach to the Jewish state.
Well, some factions in the German government are reconsidering Germany's unconditional support for Israel. Basically, there's growing frustration over Israel's construction of settlements in what some call the occupied territories. And Norbert Rorgen, he's a member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, or the CDU, and he's also chair of the German Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. On Friday, the German publication Der Spiegel interviewed him, and here's what he said. Israel's current policies are not contributing to the country remaining Jewish and democratic. We must express this concern more clearly to Israel. That's a little bit convoluted, but there's another statement here in that same Der Spiegel article. This one's by Rolf Mutzenich, who is a member of the Socialist Democrats. That's the CDU's junior coalition partner. And this statement is a little more powerful, a little more direct. He said, "The perception has been growing in the German government that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is instrumentalizing our friendship," meaning Germany's friendship with Israel. So that's pretty condemnatory. That's a pretty harsh allegation.
And what does instrumentalizing mean?
Well, using it for his personal political gain, sort of manipulating it. And this gentleman, Mutzenich, says that Netanyahu's behavior, his what he calls instrumentalizing of the German-Israeli friendship, is making him skeptical of the whole German-Israel relationship and also others in the German government. And really what triggered all of this was an article that was published in an Israeli newspaper called Israel Hayom. And this was just a few days after Merkel met with Netanyahu. And the headline of their article was, "Merkel says this isn't the time for two states." So basically just saying that was the chancellor's message to Netanyahu. Well, Merkel's advisors were furious when they saw this headline, and they said that the Israelis were really twisting her words to make it sound like she supported Israel in a manner that she didn't. And in fact, she has repeatedly made clear to Netanyahu and others in the Israeli government that she believes the effects of Israeli settlement construction in what some call those occupied territories are kind of disastrous for the goal of peace in that really tumultuous area.
Well, it is interesting to hear German politicians pushing back against Israel's characterization of its statements that way, because it does seem like Israel has really demonstrated a strong, credulity, that they look at, say, any overture of friendship on Germany's part as being a real lifeline to them. And it's especially interesting to view that in light of the fracturing relationship with the United States. And you look at Israel's isolation within the Middle East, and it's clear that they need friends, they need allies, and I think they've been just really quick to seize on any positive signs from Germany as being, this is a friendship that we can really trust. Angela Merkel, she seems like she's really played up on that, and she's been happy to entertain those kinds of overtures. But here, these other politicians are saying, well, don't be too quick. This relationship isn't necessarily what you think it is.
Yeah, that's right. And some in Israel are quite concerned about what this could mean. In the past, Merkel and most of the upper echelons of the government there in Germany have spoken about Germany's special obligation to support Israel. There's the deplorable, shameful past, the history that Germany has there in World War II at the Holocaust and the murder of some 6 million Jews. And because of that, modern Germany has always felt duty-bound to just go above and beyond and really go out of its way to extend all the support possible to Israel.
That the words that those politicians used was unconditional support. That essentially has been the policy, Germany's official policy toward Israel up till now.
Yes. Yeah, but now, at least in some factions of the government, there are calls to end that unconditional support. But I do think it's important to note that after these interviews and after the statements were issued that I read earlier, the German government officially said that these concerns are ill-founded. An official from the German government said Israel should dismiss the report. Here's a quote: "The guidelines of German Middle East policy have not changed." And then an Israeli official also responded to the claim, saying the relationship between Israel and Germany is strong and good and remains that way. So officially they're saying, look, don't worry, everything is still healthy between us. But many in Israel are still concerned about these high-ranking officials calling for an end of that unconditional support.
Well, really, within Europe, including Germany, among, say, academic circles and a lot of the more liberal politicians, there is a real antipathy for Israel and a strong, outspoken support for the Palestinians, and that goes back quite a long way. I mean, there's been among European politicians strong statements of support for the Palestinian cause, strong statements of support for a two-state solution, a real willingness to blame Israel for the problems that have existed in the Arab-Jew conflict. And we've pointed out for years how it really is concerning when viewed in the light of Bible prophecy, because Europe is presenting itself as some kind of an objective third party, that they would be able to stand up and mediate in this conflict in a way that maybe the United States couldn't, because the United States has typically been more pro-Israel, that they're more objective. But really, they've been strongly supportive of the Palestinians in a way that should give Israel pause.
That's true. I think if you look at that support and just at some of the shifting tides there in the German populace, you see that a lot of those concerns among Israelis are really well-founded. And the Trumpet has written many times about how we fully expect a massive rupture in that modern German-Israel friendship. It's something we've written about many times. I've got one article here by Trumpet columnist Mr. Brad McDonald. This one was from our August 2008 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. It's called "Can Israel Trust Germany?" And first, he makes a really compelling case just about some of those shifting tides, about some of that support among Germans for the Palestinians, and some of the rising anti-Semitism that's increasingly evident there. And then he says, Israel's leaders and media pundits ought to be asking themselves one simple question. Can Israel trust Germany? Even a child would answer with a resounding no. Yet Israel's leaders are still showing increasing trust despite the deadly anti-Semitic, anti-Israel sentiment saturating the collective German mindset. And he goes on there to say, this scenario exhibits all the signs of a spectacular double cross in the making. And that's exactly what's going to occur. And then he gets into the specific Bible prophecies that inform our view of that. And it's there in Hosea 5:13, but I would really encourage anyone to go onto thetrumpet.com and take a look at this article. It's even more relevant today, I believe, than when it was written there in 2008. It has one paragraph I'd like to read here, which basically reiterates what you were saying. Anti-Israel, anti-Semitic sentiment will continue to intensify in Germany. In spite of this deadly trend, we should expect Israel's leaders to increasingly rely on Germany as a friend and ally. They will do this for two primary reasons. First, America's ability and willingness to support Israel are both diminishing, forcing Jewish leaders to seek other alliances. Second, in the short term, the German government is foisting itself off as an ardent supporter of the Jewish state. As long as these trends exist, conditions will ripen for this vicious German double cross. So I think that in the 10 odd years since that was written, we've seen those conditions further ripen. And it's an important trend to keep an eye on, and a pretty sobering one, I think.
Yeah, you weren't here for the segment with Richard, but we were talking about just the dangers in not having that prophetic view when you're only looking at the physical circumstances. And in a lot of cases, even just looking at the physical circumstances, if your eyes are wide open and you're not looking at it with a bias, you would recognize some of those danger signs. But particularly, you're very easily can see the danger of ignoring those warning signs. And when a politician speaks out and says, well, we need to reconsider this relationship, and then the official party line says, no, don't worry about it, you don't have anything to worry about, there's something in you that says, well, who am I going to believe here? You know, am I really able to just totally dismiss those concerns and push aside the warning signs and not have any real concern that this could actually be something that will come back to haunt us?
Yeah, it makes me just very grateful to have that prophetic understanding. Without that, you would say, look, these are sort of low-level German officials who are making these statements. And on the whole, look at Germany's track record. Since World War II, they've been a very reliable friend of Israel. There's no reason to think that that's going to change in any dramatic way. But since we have this prophetic understanding that trumps any, you know, appearance of what the facts on the ground might be, through that lens, we can see that those actually are statements worth a lot of attention, even if, you know, even if the main factions in the government deny the significance of it. We sort of know what the end result is, and it's definitely something that's very sobering and is quite dramatic.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Jeremiah is also another host on Trumpet Radio. You can hear his program, The Sun Also Rises, which I really want to congratulate you on, by the way. I think the program has been really enjoyable and worth listening to. Listeners can hear that every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. Central Standard Time. You can also find it online at kpcg.fm. Thanks for coming on, Jeremiah.
Great to be with you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Last week at a Donald Trump presidential campaign rally in Orange County, California, several hundred demonstrators filled the streets. It escalated into a violent confrontation. There is real tension surrounding Mr. Trump, his supporters on one side who are adamantly supportive, and his protesters on the other who are increasingly violently opposed. Where is this leading? To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here with me. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be on the show.
So tell us first about what happened in California last week.
Yeah, well, they had a Trump rally and Orange County, California, to where he'd gotten there, and there were several hundred demonstrators there already. Him and the people with him were actually kind of forced to crawl under a fence and kind of cross a road and come into the amphitheater through the back door. And then as these protests got more and more violent over the course of the evening, there ended up being five cop cars smashed. There were several rocks thrown at motorists going by and at police officers. One police officer was hit, although I don't think there was an injury in this case because he had a helmet on. But it was just, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this in my lifetime. I mean, my grandmother can tell stories about what presidential elections were like in the 60s. But between this this riot and then the one they had back March 12th in Chicago, this doesn't seem to be going away. It seems like he's, as Mr. Trump goes around the nation giving speeches, they've got these like radical student organizations and or far left groups that are just really clamping down on his free speech rights just to give a speech for our campaign by trying to scare people away by throwing rocks at the cars going by.
So what are some of the protesters talking about? This one in California had some really interesting elements in terms of what specifically they are opposing Donald Trump for.
Right. The one in California being that it was in a very Hispanic part of the country, it was a lot of people who were very opposed to Donald Trump's immigration policy, and that's one of his policies where he hasn't even – I mean, some of his rhetoric can be childish, but his actually policy has been seems fairly moderate, and he's just saying that he wants to enforce the immigration laws that America already has and build a wall as well. But so they really had just a lot of protesters coming out against that. Some of them quite radical with you'd see signs like "Make America Mexico Again." Or you'd see signs say like, "Oh, welcome to Aztlan," which was like an ancient Aztec empire that included Mexico and the Southeast United States. And so they'll have a map on their poster that show those seven, California and the seven other Southeastern United States as part of Mexico. I saw one clip where with like a lady on there really rallying that this is our country and no white man has the right to build a wall through the middle of our country. And so it's not just like a Hispanic versus Trump thing. I mean, there are a lot of Hispanics that do come here legally or who are born here, but this is a, like a radical element in here that's really saying that, you know, historically this was settled by Mexico at one point long in the past, and we don't even consider this. The United States has no jurisdiction to tell us what to do here.
So some of these protesters actually bashing in police cars.
Yeah, I mean, I'd seen several of the videos that there were at least five at this protest. They tried to flip one over, and then that another one where it's just like people just jumping up and down on top of it till the windows broke.
What intrigues me is the fact that you have a lot of the press that have really jumped on Donald Trump's case for inciting a violent type of spirit within his supporters, within his campaign rallies, making statements like, you know, in the good old days, people like that would have been beaten up, or, you know, I preferred those days. There have been a couple of times where supporters of his have punched protesters who are at the rallies, and those protesters, they come there and they're trying to disrupt his campaign rally. They're expressing their disdain for what he's saying. When his supporters confront them, the press has really said, you know, he is creating the problem. But I don't hear them calling these protesters to task for the kind of violence that they're perpetuating.
Right. And Mr. Trump's rhetoric definitely is a problem. I mean, he said a lot of inflammatory things, but so far, the vast majority of any sort of violence that broke out at his rallies has been someone who's come in from some other organization looking to cause a disturbance, and sometimes some of his protesters gave them what they're looking for. So that is true that we do, some of the media, and rightly so, has called out some of the problems with Mr. Trump's rhetoric, but we really haven't seen the fact that it's the other side that's flipping over the police cars and breaking the windows and throwing rocks at the motorists going by. So they have just as much accountability, if not more, than the Trump supporters
right.
at
well,
these events.
It seems like the general view is that that is a legitimate form of protest, whereas the way that Trump is speaking is he's outside of the bounds of what is politically acceptable within the country, and we would expect a candidate to hold himself to a higher standard. But you can see the reaction among his supporters really seems to be a backlash against this politically correct view that is being enforced and is being perpetuated by the media. They're saying, look, finally somebody is standing up and they're saying uncomfortable truths and they're saying what needs to be said. There's a certain reaction to that. And you watch these two forces coming up against one another, and it's hard to see how one of them is going to back down.
No, I've got one quote here from an official from the California Immigration Youth Justice Alliance. That's one of the groups that organized this protest, where he's saying that, I think it's going to get worse if he gets the nomination and is the front runner. I think it's going to escalate. We're going to keep showing up and standing against the actions and the hate Donald Trump is creating. We are continue to show up in numbers and stand together. So he's saying that from these organizations that organized this protest that resulted in all this destruction, I mean, they're not backing down. They're saying if he gets the nomination, which at this point looks highly likely, they're going to keep organizing these protests as he goes across the nation. And like you said, the Trump supporters, they're not one. He's not going to cancel the rallies just because there are protesters there. And so it's discerning. It's concerning. It looks like there could be a lot more of the violence like we saw in Chicago and in Orange County.
It seems like we're looking at the possibility of one of two outcomes, or at least two outcomes that are very conceivable. One is that Donald Trump secures the nomination, and that provokes a lot of opposition on the other side. These violent acts that we're seeing taking place, this is while he's just campaigning. He's not even the candidate yet. He's not the official representative of the Republican Party. There's just a whole lot of people who are being stirred up by his candidacy. But the other scenario that you could see play out would be that for some way or other, the Republican Party denies him the candidacy, and then the Trump supporters feel betrayed, or they feel like they've been done wrong by, and they protest. And there's some kind of either political fallout that really results in some kind of a collapse of the Republican Party, or its failure to really have any kind of a strong majority, or, you know, the disenfranchisement of those voters ends up manifesting itself in other unpleasant ways.
Well, I've definitely heard that. I think it's in June. They've got the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. At this point, it's mathematically impossible for either Ted Cruz or John Kasich to secure the 1,237 delegates they need for a nomination outright. But Trump might not make that threshold either. And so if he doesn't get to there, it's like a complicated Vatican-style political conclave they do. Where they pick a candidate based on the delegates there, and so it is possible they could pick another candidate other than Trump at that convention if he doesn't get to 1,237, which would be fairly unpopular, just because even though Trump, if he didn't get to the 1,237, he would definitely still have had the most votes by that point. So if they gave it to someone who had less delegates than Trump did,
It'd be
very, very interesting to see how Trump supporters would respond to that. And I do know the local law enforcement in Cleveland has really been beefing up on riot gear in preparation for that convention, just in case some of Trump supporters didn't take kindly to if he loses that convention.
Well, really, we just watching this unfold, and in light of the prophecies that we talk about so often about the cities in America burning and the violence within urban population centers really increasing to a point where you've got social breakdown on a pretty massive scale. It really does feel like you could see how these events that we're seeing in this presidential campaign are leading to that kind of fulfillment.
Yeah, it's definitely very high tensions on both sides. July's normally, if you see it graphed, July's by like four or five fold the biggest month for race riots anyway, just because it's warm outside. So you get into the summertime when things like that, it seems like for at least the last two or three years, they've had some major civil unrest in America during the summer anyway. But then this year, especially with the resurrection of the Black Power movement through Black Lives Matter, and then you've got this opposite side of the coin with these Trump supporters that seem to think that he can do no wrong, and,
right.
and neither side's backing down. But
yeah, he's made the statements that he could walk out in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York and kill somebody, and people still wouldn't. Abandoned him, that he'd still be able to retain the support of his supporters. It is remarkable just how adamant they are in insisting that he's the solution to the problems that ail the nation, and just how strong the opposition is on the other side. We've got an immovable force and a rock and a hard place here.
Right. It's it does seem like the breakdown of the rule of law and then replacing that with like the return of identity politics, and the fact that I remember seeing a Hillary Clinton campaign, I think back in January, where she was criticizing Bernie Sanders for treating all poor people equally. She said he's just concerned about the poor. She said, but said just being concerned about the poor, that's not going to help all blacks, or that's not going to help all women's, or that's not going to help all homosexuals, and so. She's basically dividing the nation into like these tribes. You've got like the homosexual tribe and someone's got to be for them. And you've got the black tribe and someone's got to be for them. And the Hispanic tribe and someone's going to be for them. And the women and someone's got to be for them. And she listed like every single demographic group in America except for white men. And so Trump's seen his niche, and he's gone in to kind of champion that group. And I think a lot of them, it's been a long time since some of that group have felt like they've had someone who spoke for them, but it's still, it's still dangerous as you're getting like this tribalism type of politics where everyone's right. for their group instead of where everyone's supposed to be equal before the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think looking at it in terms of tribalism really is an interesting way of looking at it. There's a definite fragmentation, a definite intensification of the political views and social views of these different segments of society, and you see them really coming together for inevitable increasing clashes. So definitely something we need to keep our eyes on. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the growing tension in this presidential race within America. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Owning a home is wonderful, but it's also a lot of work. And the reason for that is that everything breaks down. This is a fact of life that God actually designed physical things to decay and return to dust. That's true of our homes, our gardens, our possessions, our vehicles, even our own bodies. They all break down. We have to take care of them. We have to perform regular routine maintenance in order to preserve them and protect them and keep them in good working order. Now, you can look at this as a hassle, but I think it's more helpful to look at it as an opportunity that is really worth embracing. You know, if you don't consider yourself a maintenance man, then start. There are skills that are really valuable to learn, and you might as well embrace it. Proverbs 24 says this: I went by the field of the slothful and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding, and lo, it was all grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof, and the stone wall thereof was broken down. Then I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. So this is talking about a man who has a vineyard. You know, even a sluggard can acquire things. It doesn't necessarily take a lot to get something or to buy something. That's the easy part. Taking care of what you have, that's the hard part. But when you don't do it, look what happens. The thorns come, the nettles, the stone wall breaks down. Now, so many people look at that and they say the solution is, well, don't worry about it. Just buy new stuff. Throw that away and get a new one. We're so prosperous that we tend to just get more and more. But if you do that, you're going to find your life is full of stuff. And if you don't get rid of it, if you're not cleaning things out and purging, then you're going to find that you either spend a ton of time just trying to maintain those things, or you're going to watch it all just break down. Don't let stuff just come into your life and pile up. Really, everything that you want, before you buy it, ask yourself whether you also want to maintain it. When you own something, you'd better plan to maintain it. And if you can't do that, you'd probably be better off not getting it or getting rid of it. Limit your possessions to what you can take care of. We have to learn to maintain what we have rather than just getting new stuff. Take care of what you have. There's really a certain joy in that when you embrace that duty. Take an inventory of what you own. Is it all in good working order? Think about that picture in Proverbs 24 and ask yourself this question: what does the state of my possessions say about the state of my character? The author of this proverb, he saw a field and a vineyard and a wall, and he said, okay, this is clearly owned by a slothful man. It's owned by a man who's void of understanding. He said, I considered it well, I looked upon it, and I received instruction. Now, if you look at the things that you own, you see things breaking down and what it requires to actually maintain a house, a garden, a car. Face your fears. Those skills can be learned. There are a lot of resources out there that can help you. And obviously, we all have limits on our time and so on, but it is really important to, you know, go after those things that need to be taken care of. Watch an online video, read an online source about how to do it, get a book about it. You know, if you have a friend or a family member who knows how to do those things to help you, to walk you through that or give you advice, it's really worthwhile to do that. In a book called Created for Work, author Bob Schultz said this, "What a man acquires doesn't matter much, for goods may come by work, gifts, or just being in the right spot at the right time. What he does with what comes is a test that reveals his outlook on life, good, and God. The getting isn't hard, the keeping is. It's easier to open a checking account than to keep it balanced. You know, it's easier to buy a nice car than to keep a car nice. It's easier to get happily married than to stay happily married. But it is important not to have a throwaway mentality. Just think about the fact that when God put Adam in the garden, he said, I want you to dress it and keep it, preserve it, maintain it. God created it to need maintenance, and really everything in our material life needs maintenance, even our relationships with other people. But God did that in order to build our character and to help us to think like him. He is a sustainer. He creates and he maintains what he creates. So let's learn to think like God and to work like God. There's a real vision in looking after your things and taking care of the blessings that God gives you. So embrace your duty as a maintenance man. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, the trumpet writers Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondo. And I'll leave you with this thought from Daniel Greenfield. Adulthood means doing things you don't want to do and discovering that they can make you the person you want to be. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.